Well, so here we are. Everybody get comfy. We're gonna, as you know, we're spending this year on the Four Noble Truths. And I had the privilege of sharing the Dhamma on last Monday, and this beginning is the same if you were there. I'm saying the same first paragraph in that I'm so grateful that our three guiding teachers set a theme for the year. And many of you participated all last year as we were studying and practicing with the paramis. And I think all of us, when we talked about it, especially towards the end of the year, we all felt so cozy and warm and lovey-dovey around the paramis. And somebody even said, "Can't we do the paramis for a second year?" But no, we're not. Instead, our guiding teachers have thrown us into the deep end of the pool because the Four Noble Truths are a different kind of teaching. And they still, just like with the paramis, we're still being encouraged to feel them, not just know about them conceptually. But these Four Noble Truths are complicated. And in January, we looked at dukkha. The Pali word for dissatisfaction. And we were encouraged to really feel the ouch of it. And so now we're in the second month, and I'm giving the last talk of this month on the source of dukkha, the reason why we suffer, which is because we cling. It is said that the Buddha said that we who understand clinging understand the whole of the Dhamma. So this is pretty important stuff. And I wanted to share four kinds of clinging. And this morning I'm going to talk about the four kinds, but I'm going to do that through the teaching about the eight worldly winds. So kind of mixing a couple teachings together, and hopefully this will be of benefit to folks. So there's four kinds of clinging. The first is sense objects. And so it's not only those objects that we want, that new blouse that Lyndall had talked about a couple of weeks ago, which we never heard whether you actually bought it or not. But it's also all those things that we use to entertain ourselves, TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, traveling, streaming, all of that. And how we believe so strongly that once we get them, we will be so happy. But of course, we also have talked about this whole month that sometimes we get these objects and then they feel good for a little bit, or maybe we thought we really wanted them, but in the end, they didn't do what we thought. So sense objects, we get really caught up in our clinging to them. The second kind is views and opinions, where we take ownership and a sense of identification with what we think and believe. We forget that these are just subjective opinions, but we act as if they are some kind of truth, that they're the facts. The mind is so filled, I don't know about your mind, but certainly my mind, with I know, I believe, I feel, and therefore this is who I am. And we hold on to these views and opinions so tightly, and then we get caught. The third kind, they call them rules and norms. It's really the way I understand that is this belief of the way things are supposed to be, our own kind of traditions that we've set up. It shows up in daily life, like how the dishwasher is supposed to be loaded, but it also shows up in our practice, how my practice is supposed to be going. I had one of these kind of rules or norms about retreats. For years, I'd go on a retreat 7 or 10 days or a couple of weeks, and the third day of the retreat, I would refer to as Euphoria Day. It was the day when the body finally settled down, Sleepiness disappeared and the mind quieted. And it always felt like a real turning point in my retreat. So of course, and you know, so instead of it just being something I noticed, it became this expectation that this is the way retreats go. Well, of course, you know the end of this story, that a couple of years ago I was on retreat at Cloud Mountain. Third day came, nothing happened. The body was still as restless as ever. I was sleepy all the time, and the mind was not settled. So not only did I still have the ending of, you know, another 5 to 8 days of the retreat being challenging, but I also had the added disappointment of not meeting this expectation that had become quite fixed. Again, I was caught. And the fourth kind of clinging is this fixed sense of self, the beliefs about ourselves. This is who I am. This is who I've always been. This is who I always will be. I always respond this way. But of course, we know that this sense of self isn't solid. It, along with everything else, changes all the time. But regardless, we act as if there is a fixed sense of self and we get caught. Ajahn Sumedho, who's one of the resources, if you go on the website and go to this year's teaching and you'll see all the resources, he says that this sense of wanting is often about wanting to be something other than we are right now. He talked about how much of his meditation as a monk, when he was, especially in his early years, was wanting to be liked and approved of, wanting praise, wanting to be seen and validated and appreciated. I don't know about you, but I can identify with that desire. So now I want to just switch for a minute to the eight worldly winds, because I think they're a doorway into understanding this second noble truth of clinging. And they're kind of challenging too. I'm going to try to screen share right now the eight worldly winds. Can people see those? Yeah, good. The winds show up in each of these kinds of clinging. So the winds are gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, and fame and disrepute. So they show up in every kind of clinging. You know, certainly gain and loss can be seen in the clinging to sense objects, things, experiences, the pull of social media. Pleasure and pain show up in all of these as well. Sometimes it's just really painful when things don't go our way. Views and opinions and rules and norms. And it's within this fourth kind of clinging where two of the worldly winds, I think, really show up most often, the praise and blame and fame and ill repute. A couple of years ago, maybe it was 4 years ago, when we talked about the eight worldly winds, I think I remember Lindell describing these are the areas where that really come from relationships and how we want to be seen. There are a couple nuns. Oh, Rachel, did you need to ask something?
I was going to say, could you?
I can't hear you.
Yeah, it just muted me. But if you scroll down, we would be able to see all of them right now. I don't know about everyone else, but I only see two of the
Thank you
four.
Very yeah. much. Thank you. I will scroll. Is that better?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for pointing that out. That's great. So there are these two nuns. We now have two sets of nuns in our area, one down in Olympia and one up in Port Townsend. And Bhikkhuni Santachitta co-wrote a small book with Bhikkhuni Ananda Bodhi. They're up in Port Townsend. And she shared some really great insights on these eight worldly winds. Her book is called Leaving It All Behind. She says these winds are grouped into four pairs and they always arise together. We desire praise and we fear blame. We desire gain, we fear loss. We desire to be well liked and we fear being criticized or ignored. We desire pleasant things and we fear unpleasant things. And she says, most importantly, these pairs are a way of speaking how life feels when we relate to everything in terms of me and mine. And she says, if one is blowing really strongly, at some time it will blow softly or not at all. And if one is blowing now, a different one's going to blow later. She describes these winds as just weather. And there's a way of looking at all this clinging and all of this selfing as just weather. When we see it that way, we can decide not to make such a big fuss about it all. The winds aren't going away. And what happens in our practice is that we get to know them intimately and we learn about how they do arise and pass away. And we don't make them into such a big deal. I love how she says in her book that even when we're enlightened, autumn still turns into winter, and winter still turns into spring. The Dhamma, she says, is a manual on how to meet this constant flow, this river of life, with an open mind and an open heart. So I said at the beginning of my talk that the Buddha said, we who understand clinging understand the whole of the Dhamma. So while it kind of gives pause and you go, oh my goodness, this is big stuff, the bigness of it for me also creates a very strong intention to understand this whole area of clinging. So as I mentioned, all four of these winds happen all the time in our lives. But the last two, praise and blame and fame and ill repute, they really happen as part of being social creatures and how we are part of the world, how the world sees us, how we want to be seen in these world, in the world. The Buddha said that these eight come and go. But to be happy, we want to rest like a great tree in the midst of them. It's an invitation to rest in the midst of them, in all of the ups and downs, all the turmoil. And my view or image of resting is, you know how trees, they're so big and strong, but they sway in the wind? That's what I think is where we're trying to get to, is a place where we can just sway in the wind when these winds are blowing strong. So I started looking at when can I feel like I can actually sway in the breeze of praise and blame? And when do I have trouble swaying? The first insight that arose was about my attitude about myself. When I'm basically in a pretty positive place about my life, about kind of who I am, how I'm functioning, I'm not filled with so much self-judgment or recriminations, then I can be pretty open to the feedback that comes in, whether it comes from another person or just life showing us, wow, you kind of screwed up on that one, honey. And when I'm in really enmeshed in a place of self-criticism, not liking myself or my life, the blaming and shaming that comes my way seems to confirm what I already believed about myself, that I'm not okay. It's one of those beautiful paradoxes of the Dhamma, like the paradox of anatta, of selfing. We really need a strong sense of self in order to understand what self is and what self isn't, whether it's solid, whether this experience has to be all about me or not. So that first insight about, when you can just accept yourself for who you are, doing the best you can, can really help how we relate to that, those winds of praise and blame and fame and disrepute. We all carry so many identities about who we are. On Monday night, I shared a couple that I developed as part of my family of origin. One was Susie Sunshine, which is how I, as a little girl, tried to make my very unhappy mother get cheered up. And of course, it never worked, but I developed such a good, strong skill and identity about Susie Sunshine that she still shows up whether it's appropriate or not. And the other one was this idea that I've got this, I'm on top of it. But this morning, I want to talk about two other identities. And just as a way of kind of encouraging you to look at some of those that you may be holding on to a little strongly. So one of my identities, in terms of like how I want to present myself to the world, is as a good landlord. I have seven small business tenants here, and I really kind of am proud of myself for being fair and reasonable and even-handed and respectful. But not too long ago, one of my tenants left in a real angry, accusatory way, and I got pretty rattled. My intention is there, and my behavior is mostly pretty consistent, but not everybody experiences me that way. And the suffering that I experienced when this tenant stirred up such a fuss was more about the self-created image of who I am as a landlord than the facts of the situation itself. Another identity, so I have lived where I am for almost 40 years. And for the first 30, I lived in what my neighbors unaffectionately called the junkyard. My partner was a collector of amazing proportions, wood, steel, plastic, tools, you name it. He had so many collections. And so for years, I was known as the junkyard lady. And I liked how it kind of gave me this mystique, a kind of charm, allowed me to be seen as edgy and interesting. But then Bill died 7 years ago, and I spent 2 years, I got rid of over 220 tons of his stuff. So it doesn't look anything like a junkyard anymore. And I like how it looks, but I miss that possibility of being seen as edgy, interesting, charming, you know. Now I'm just me. So we have these identities, and one of the ways that I think clinging around the sense of self comes up is how we receive critical feedback. Years ago, when those of us who were assistant teachers were just starting with Sundays and sometimes substituting for Tim and Tuari on Monday nights, Tim met with us, and he gave us some time to give mini Dharma talks and to also come up with responses to usual Dharma questions. So each of us would have a turn, and then the rest of us would give us feedback. And I remember the way Tim talked about how to deal with feedback, which I want to share with you. He said, if the feedback comes in and it resonates and you go, oh, wow, I can really feel the truth of this, then you integrate it, you reflect on it, and you do better next time. But there's some feedback that comes in and it doesn't resonate. It doesn't feel accurate. And he reminded us that feedback is just another person's perspective, their preference, and opinion. We have skillful choices available to us. Solid feedback can be appreciated and take responsibility for, and we integrate. But when criticism or blame are misplaced, we can still respond skillfully, but we don't have to take it in as a belief of who I am. We also, you know, we've all done meta practices, and usually when you use the phrases, we get to a difficult person and we offer them wishes of well-being. And I remember many years ago, we had this visiting teacher who said she came to the realization she was at least one person's difficult person. I don't know how many other people find me their difficult person, but I know that I'm not everybody's cup of tea, and neither are you. And so that kind of sobering truth, that it's just part of the natural law of life, that not everybody's gonna click with you. The related topic to praise and blame is also how we handle disappointment. We get so worked up when we don't get what we want. Sometimes life really deals us a very difficult hand. Health problems, money problems, the death of a loved one, our aging bodies and minds. But when we don't accept these events and processes as just what is happening, just the natural unfolding of life, we add suffering to the harshness of these events. I said this earlier, but I really think it's worth repeating from Philip Moffat. He says, when you reject the moment that is arising because it isn't what you wanted, you are rejecting the only moment you have in which to be alive, the only moment in which you can feel and act. So I want to spend a few moments on exploring more. What are the practices that we can use that can help us come and go like the wind, to rest like a tree, to sway, to be happy, rest like a great tree in the midst of all of these winds? And the first one, of course, as with everything, is our mindfulness practice, which is really paying attention to what is actually happening. The dukkha, the clinging, the resistance, the acceptance, all of the responses that arise in us. We see what's happening, the winds, the weather, and we stand right under the weather, the storms and the sunshines. We allow ourselves to fully feel what is occurring. We feel the ouch of it, which is what we talked about a lot last month around dukkha. We don't brush things aside too quickly. We stay with the discomfort. Secondly, we slow down and give ourselves some time to investigate what might be underneath the response you have. And we ask ourselves some good questions. Is my sense of identity being threatened? Am I taking a single event and turning it into a story about my life and who I am and believing that that story will last? Am I receiving feedback and I immediately believe that it's true without really examining it? Am I bringing a sense of this longing to belong, to be liked and appreciated, to a situation which is really just simple and actually can never even get close to meet that longing? And we bring the paramis with us, patience, wisdom, resolve, energy, kindness. Let's not forget about renunciation, seeing the benefits and drawbacks. Albert Camus has this wonderful quote. He says, sometimes the winds bring pretty heavy stuff our way. No way to deny that, or really no way to make it our fault. No matter how hard the world pushes against me, within me, there's something stronger, something better, pushing right back. So I ask you to consider what's inside of you that is pushing right back. For me, it's the Dhamma. It's the practice. It provides so much perspective and choice. And the Parami of equanimity is really a fabulous ally. I want to end with some more comments from Bhikkhuni Santacitta. She reminds us that these worldly winds are a source of energy, and we don't want to block them. We don't want to push them away. Let's figure out how to use these energies in a way that can help us awaken. We want to learn how to harness that precious energy to propel us along the path of awakening. She uses a beautiful image of a prayer flag as part of her instruction on how do we abandon clinging, you know, the fifth insight. This is what she says. Whenever our internal winds are blowing, we can bring the image of a prayer flag to mind and let go into the wind. When the energy gets too high, we feel for the pole that is holding our prayer flag. It's a pole that's deep in the ground. It's a pole of awareness and grounding ourselves. We can become one with the rhythm of the wind and move with it. In this way, we are allowing all experiences to teach us. She says, when we make our own prayer flag, and this is probably just something that's going to happen in our minds. Maybe you'll be able to make a real one. You can put your central motivation on it. Mine, which I've shared quite a bit over the years of Sunday, my main central motivation is to trust in the natural unfolding of life and receive the unfolding with ease. There's wind, there's the pole, there's the ground into which the pole is connected, and there's the flag. The flag we call body and mind with our foremost intention written right across the fabric of our lives. All the ways we think, speak, and act. That's the path. And we just need to keep going. Thank you so much for your attention and listening to me as I share my own experience of this second noble truth. And one of the things that I think makes Sangha such a beautiful refuge, one of the three refuges, is how much we learn from each other. And there's such an honesty that happens when we're in Sangha. I'd like to extend a strong invitation to all of you, if you're able to stay with us as we go into small groups. I know it's a bit of a stretch. Remember, in the small groups, you can always decide to be silent and just be a listener and a presence. But if you're going to participate, we have a few guidelines. You listen with kindness and good attention. You don't interrupt. You give everybody their time. We don't give advice. Certainly, if somebody asks for advice from the group, absolutely share. And then we treat what comes up in our groups with kindness and sensitivity and confidentiality. So when we come back into the large group, we only share from our own experience. Certainly, you can talk about the group, but you don't divulge what someone else shared. So hopefully many of you are going to stay, which is lovely. And while I'm opening the rooms, I'm going to give you a couple different prompts. You probably don't need them. You know, which of the winds blows most strongly for you? Or are there some identities that you're holding on to pretty tightly that perhaps have stopped being very beneficial to you? Or just, not that the identity, there's anything wrong with it, but it's that closed fist that I'm always this way and it's always about this being me. So enjoy your groups and you'll have about 15 minutes and I'll send a little broadcast. Any questions? Everybody good? Okay, enjoy. Hi, everybody. So if you have ability to unmute, and if you want to go down to React, the at the bottom of your screen, there's when you click on that, it'll show a way of holding up your virtual hand. Okay. So, Judith, thank you for getting us started.
You know,
Please share.
one thing that came up just right toward the end of our group that I was interested in exploring more is when we lose one of our identities that we have been clinging to, you know, when life just removes it, and how painful that is. But at the same time, when the dust settles, it seems to be very freeing. And I know I've had that experience several times, and thought you might say more about that.
Yeah, oh, that's a great reminder. Going back to my example of being the junk lady,
Yeah.
it really gave me an opportunity to manage my village here differently, just on my own. That I was no longer part of that team. It gave me some freedom to just ask myself, well, how did I want to be here? Yeah, I think that's a really good point about when the dust settles, and there's going to be dust when we let go of something that's no longer serving us, and that asking ourselves that beautiful question that comes from the renunciation parami of when you look at the benefits, but also the drawbacks. And when you really feel the drawback, and then you can go, oh, maybe I can just have a softer relationship with it. And then, anyone else want to speak to that or any other part of this beautiful clinging that creates so much unhappiness for us. Claire, please. Nice to have you here in
Thank you.
California. Claire used to be a local.
So I think about retiring and how that has, I think for a lot of us, retiring is a perfect time to practice letting go of a persona. And you know, it's forces us to figure out what's left and who am I if I'm not this working person who does this particular job. I think that's been a great opportunity for growth, and it's difficult. It's not like it's an easy road.
Absolutely. I hear that from so many friends, and we get such a sense of meaning and purpose from our work life, and we spend so much time there that it makes sense that there's a loss of it. I retired once before when I stopped with a recycling company, and I realized in the first year or so, one of the biggest losses is I had finally become a good boss, and then I no longer had a business with any employees, so I was no longer had the opportunity to be a boss, good or bad. And yeah, thank you for sharing that. Lillian and Nikhil, please, our friends from Idaho, thanks for joining us.
Something that came up for me during our small group was that, you were talking during the talk about how, you know, like our identities and our sense of self, can cause so much, you know, of our suffering. And that, I think that's, you know, for me too, that's like very true. And, something that came up for me during our discussion was that I think a lot of it for me stems from maybe a need for more metta towards the self, and how there is this the viewing this aspect of who I want to be and how I want to be viewed as like good. And like, there is a lack of meta towards not that, anything that's like doesn't fall within that, and not having meta for like that self that might sometimes be present and manifest as well. And how, you know, just like kind of a need for more meta towards itself as a whole, regardless of like how it's manifesting. To, you know, try and maybe bridge that suffering a little bit.
Wow. Thank you for that. I think that's really important. We send metta out to all these other beings, and metta for the self that either we feel we are or we feel we aren't. All of that. What a good idea. I wanted to just give everyone it's early warning. Lyndall and Judith and Steve Wilhelm and I, and maybe a couple others, we're going to offer a day long on anatta, on self, probably in the spring. We're really looking forward to spending a whole day where all of these nuances of how do we navigate this, you know, all of our little selves in these little boxes. Anyway, and that, what you just brought up, Nikhil, of also bring metta to our sense of self, and both who we think we are and who we wish we were and who we aren't, and all of that. Thank you for that. Jean.
I've been chuckling all morning because I finally heard the message in the Worldly Winds, and I realized that I have an excellent opportunity to explore where Worldly Winds and where they show up and how they play out in my life, and it's been good to consider how much clinging there is in it, and I can see myself in all these things, and it's just like, what a joke sometimes, how I forced my mind and how I thought about things in a certain way, and there's just not enough freedom in it. So I'm looking forward to exploring what's happening with blame in particular when this meeting is over.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Jean. And this book that I mentioned, and it's just one chapter in it, I got it for free at Clear Mountain Monastery. They have all these books. That's where I got it. And then it's also, I'm going to put this in the chat. It's also is a free book at this, I'll put it in the chat. But thank you. Yeah. And the winds are always blowing, you know. They're always blowing, and they're not a problem. That's the other piece. They're really not a problem. They're just more information that we can practice with. So I wish you well in that exploration.
Thank you.
And what you said too about it being a joke. Sometimes you look at your life and you go, really? I mean, it is like a joke, a bad joke, or maybe a good joke. I don't know. So let me put this, how you can get this book as a free book at alokavihara.org. Alokavihara is the name of their little mini monastery. So there it is. And also, if you lose it, you can always email me, Suze at Seattle Insight, and I can send it to you. Okay, so we probably have room for one more comment, or I can just go into some announcements. There's some fun things that are happening in March. Everybody's good? Great.
I just want to say one thing. Hi. Sorry.
That's okay. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi. And I appreciate this. I'm sorry I was late today. I just want to share, I just keep hearing in everyone's shares, so much is just about letting go of control, however that looks for anyone. But I just see good things coming from that.
Yeah.
It's such a theme.
Yeah.
Trying to control and just suffering because of it.
Yeah. Yesterday morning, one of the monks put the Buddhist interpretation of the Serenity Prayer, which is really what we're about, so that you see what are the things that I have control over, that I have agency with, which things I don't, and the wisdom to know the difference between that. And because we're not just pawns, we're not just being blown around only. We also have agency in our lives, and we have choices. And really the practice, an elderly monk who came to Clear Mountain some months ago, he was asked, after all these years of practice, what's the most important thing you've learned? And he said, coming up with an appropriate response. So there we have it. We have choice every time we respond in body, mind, and heart. And thank you for reminding us about that. Thank you so much for being with us. And just, I know we're 2 minutes over. There's so much hurt and uncertainty and fear right now in our small communities and in the larger communities. It's just a lot of uncertainty and people are scared. And I love the sincerity and the wisdom that comes from all of our practices. May we dedicate the merit of each of our practices, of our willingness to see truth, to practice and be with what is going on. And may we extend that out to our small communities, those of us here this morning, all your family and friends, the city of Seattle, the state of Washington and Idaho and California and everywhere else that people are from, but also to all beings everywhere. May all beings find ease in life just as it is. Take care. Hope to see you all soon. Enjoy those winds.